That recent news was brought to you by Cars for Kids. I am brought to you by the fact that Bill and Wendy are not here today. They're probably cooking or something. I'm Rick Kogan. It is my unbelievable pleasure to finally have on one of my various radio iterations, Mary Wisniewski in here. She has written a book, and you interviewed me for this book, too, Mary.
That's right. You're in it.
That's the best part of it, right? Never had an affair with Nelson Algren, thank God. But Algren, A Life, is the definitive biography of Chicago's street poet. One of the things that amazes me about Nelson, Mary, is that with all the great writers that this town has produced, including Nobel Prize winners like Saul Bellow, Algren remains at the top of this kind of pantheon. And I sometimes don't get it because, and I'm sure you experience this too, a lot of people have never read Nelson. Don't you think that's true?
It is, because he's a tough lift sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Because not only because his language is so poetic and so dense, and so it's kind of it's beautiful language, but it can be difficult to get through. And also because of the subjects he writes about, which are not just people who are at the bottom of the social ladder. They're people who have fallen off the ladder altogether.
Yeah.
And are lying in the gutter or trying to make their way through petty crime or maybe not so petty crime. And I think that's one reason that he's difficult for people. But I think that the reason he remains on top is because he changed the way we look at the city. He changed the language that we have for Chicago. When you talk about Chicago as being like a woman with a broken nose, you may find lovelier lovelies, but never a lovely so real. That comes from Algren. He's like the way Van Gogh changes the way we look at sunflowers. Or like Dickens changes the way we look at London. He's defined the city for us.
Melville, the way we look at Wales.
It looked at Wales, right.
At Wales. So. Let me ask you, I know, and I've seen you interviewed on a variety of shows, Chicago Tonight, among other places, and read many of your interviews about how you fell in love with Nelson. But in order to write this book, you had to revisit everything he wrote.
That's
you
right.
You had to reread it, if not once, many times. What is your now assessment of Algren?
I think that he is a great poet of the underclass, and I think that he never took his eyes off the poor. It's like Vonnegut said, he's almost like Christ, and then he never takes his eyes off the poor. I think that he was able to see something that other writers weren't able to see, that the crust of civilization in this country can be very fragile. And it can be easy to break through, and it can be easy to turn into something that you never expected to be. And so my regard for him actually improved over the years. There are a couple of his works which I don't think I'll read again. His last novel, The Double Stocking, I give it a miss.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some of his works like Chicago City on the Make and Man with a Golden Arm, which I will keep reading over and over again.
When did you first get hooked on Nelson?
When I was 19.
And why?
I was in college, and I was, like a lot of kids in college, I was interested in the underworld. I was interested in reading Hunter S. Thompson and people like that. And so Nelson Algren wasn't part of the canon. He wasn't up there with Jane Austen and Herman Melville. But someone recommended that I read The Man with the Golden Arm because it was about the underclass. And I read it, and I thought, holy cow, this is set in my family's old neighborhood.
Yeah, that's the thing for you. It hooked you in part because it struck so close to home. He was writing about intersections you knew and places you knew and neighborhoods you
knew. And dialects I knew. People in Man with the Golden Arm used that Polish-American Chicago dialect where you would say something like, I got to go buy jewels instead of I got to go to jewels. And he got it. He got that dialect. He talked like my relatives.
Reading him and then deciding later in your career, and Mary Wisniewski has had a very distinguished career in journalism, currently at the Tribune covering that astonishingly complicated beat called transportation. When did you decide? It's a big leap, Mary, from, well, this is an interesting person, to, well, I think I'm going to devote a huge portion of my life to chronicling the life of this very interesting person. When did that happen, and why?
It started in 2004. The reason it happened is because I've been working in journalism. I kept running into people who knew Algren because he hung around a lot with writing circles and journalism circles, and they would tell me stories, and they'd be funny stories or they'd be moving stories. And I thought, you know, there should be, you know, someone should write a biography of him. And also, I was a bit of an Algren nag with people. I would be thrusting copies of Six City on the Make on everyone I knew. And I wanted to promote him. I wanted to make more people aware of him. And there is a biography that was written,
Bettina
Drews in 89, which is a wonderful, wonderfully researched book. But I wanted to I thought it should have more of a Chicago flavor and should have more of the stories that I was hearing. And that's what inspired me to start doing the research. And I had no idea how to do this. I'd never written a biography before. Yeah.
I remember we talked early on in the whole process, and you were passionate. There's no question about it. Did you get frustrated along the way?
Certainly did, because the publishing, it's a very difficult business, and increasingly
You dove into the book publishing business when the book publishing business was exploding.
Right.
And not in a good way either.
Right. And it wasn't about diets, and it wasn't about, you know, a current celebrity. Yeah. It was kind of about a literary figure who's a bit obscure, you know, or has been outside of Chicago. And so it was difficult to find a publisher, and I was really happy to find Chicago Review Press willing to take this on. But I think that Algren's time is coming back. We've just had a couple of documentaries about him.
Well, that's an astonishing thing to me. I've written about them. I think I was in one of them. Because I, just to give you some background, I, Rick Kogan, my parents were dear and close friends of Nelson's, and he had a tortured relationship with one of my mother's sisters, and was part of my life since I was a little kid. He dedicated the second edition of City on the Make to my parents, and of course, spelling my mother's name wrong in that dedication too. We got to take a little break. I'm going to keep Mary this entire half hour. Again, the book, and it should be on every Christmas book list, because I love the idea of giving books. I love, and you can indeed order them online. I also like the idea of going to bookstores to get them. It is simply titled Algren, A Life. We'll be back with Mary Wisniewski. I think especially for, you know, when Mary Wisniewski, my guest, fell in, this is Rick Cohen filling in for Bill and Wendy, if you don't know that, fell in love really with Algren at 19, 20 when she was in college. Algren is a perfect kind of case study for someone that age. Don't give them a Nelson book. Give them Algren, A Life, and let them find their way to Nelson's book. Mary, before we get into the details of the great narrative drive of this biography, it's one of the best biographies. I knew Nelson. I liked him and then didn't like him. Admire him and will always admire him. There's a great narrative drive to this book, and you were telling me off air that one of the reasons is you were a theater major and you structured this like a compelling play.
Right. I love reading literary biographies, and I hate reading boring ones.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to think as I was going through his life, what's the story here? What's, you know, how can I tell this story? And so I structured it like a play in that in the first act, you see the young man rising, the young man looking for a hero, the young man trying to figure out life, finding out that, you know, his ideas about the United States and about, you know, what he can do for a living are not what he thought, and becoming a champion of the underclass. And then in the second act, you have his success, you know, what he did with The Man with the Golden Arm, being the first recipient of the National Book Award, having a long-term affair with Simone de Beauvoir, one of the most famous
literary affairs
of the 20th century.
And basically famous because of the initial passion of the fact that they later turned on each other.
They turned on each other in a pretty sad way. And then the fall from that, which happened, you know, in part because of the McCarthy era, because of his work not being accepted during that era, because of the problems that he had with the FBI, which didn't allow him to leave the country. So you have this rise up to the top of the roller coaster, and then you have this fall, and then and the fall being the third act, and how he stops being able to get contracts, he stops being able to get work. And then, you know, because I'm a Catholic girl, I like the idea of redemption.
Yeah.
He has redemption at the end because he ends up going to Long Island, and he finds people who love him again. He finds
Kurt Vonnegut, who would love and admire him,
right,
too.
He starts being in a literary society again, and he starts being accepted. His work starts being accepted again, and that's where his life ends.
One of the great things about Nelson, and you really, really highlighted here, most people don't know anything about Nelson's childhood and background. I'm just going to read a little something from the beginning of chapter two. It's about how Nelson, in many ways, was a self-manufacturer. Mary Wisniewski writes, Nelson boasted in later years that it took him 5 years to graduate high school, and then he was 141st in a class of 149. Quote, had the faculty tolerated me for one more semester, I could have passed up those eight idiots behind me, he said. If I couldn't be the brightest kid inside, I wanted to be the dumbest, end quote. He told writer H.E.F. Shag Donahue that he'd flunked everything. Mary writes, this was not true. Nelson liked to exaggerate his ineptitude to comic effect. That's a very, very telling observation, and he did it again and again and again. Did he not? Why?
Right. He liked to present himself as this lovable loser, as this clown, and present himself as, you know, as kind of always falling down and someone not to be taken seriously. And I think that he liked the clown image. He liked, you know, he liked the idea of getting a laugh for being a loser. And no, it wasn't. It was very, you know, you could find his grades. You could find his grades in his papers, which are kept at Ohio State University.
Yeah.
And he actually wasn't too bad a student. He struggled in his freshman and sophomore years, but he caught up. He started getting good grades in certain things. And really influential on him was his sister, Bernice, who was a Chicago public school teacher and who believed in him and who loaned him money to go to the University of Illinois in Champaign, where he ended up majoring in journalism, which was very rare at that time.
One of the other things you point out, and it's a great line here, I'm just trying to find it, ladies and gentlemen. He applied to the City News Bureau, and Mary Wisniewski writes in her amazing biography, Ogden's Life, anyone could work for City News. It was considered a stepping stone into the city's newspapers. Nelson couldn't work for City News, could he?
No, he couldn't. And though, you know, one of the problems that he had was that no one could work for anywhere in 1931.
Yeah, yeah.
He graduated in probably the worst time you can graduate with a degree in journalism, except maybe now. So he couldn't. He looked for work all over the place.
Do you think that's one of the reasons? I certainly do. And your book makes the case that he was drawn more to journalists and newspaper folk than he was to what passed at his time for the Chicago literary scene. I mean, Royko was a great friend and a great.
Right.
Mike didn't idolize many people, but I think he did idolize Nelson. And Mike at the time was as good a columnist as this country's ever seen. Do you think that's part of it, too, that he wanted to be part of that?
He wanted to. He wanted to be, you know, he said he was willing to be the guy writing obits.
Yeah.
At night. And later on in his life, when he started to see his novels fall off in their reputation, he started to refer himself as a journalist.
Yeah. And he did for some magazines, do some journalism.
Right. He did stuff from, he went to Vietnam in the late 60s. He was in Saigon, and he did journalism from there. He did journalism from other places in Asia and wrote about prostitution. He wrote about a lot of the same things that he wrote about in his novels,
yeah.
Except, you know, yeah. in real life as a journalist.
He really was one of the people who has kept the Nelson Ogden flame alive is the 90, I can't remember, I just wrote about him, the 90-something photographer Art Shea. Art was covering Nelson for Life magazine, I think, or Look magazine.
He wanted to, and
yeah.
Though the feature didn't end up working out.
Right.
And so he helped create this image that Nelson already wanted to create as being kind of a hard luck guy in a hard luck place. Nelson, you know, there's this kind of image of him as always being followed around by a jazz quartet, you know, going through this film noir night of Chicago when really, you know, Nelson was a quiet guy who loved good literature,
right.
Was a terrible poker player, was a terrible gambler.
You have this lovely, lovely anecdote on page 121. Mary Wisniewski in Algren of Life writes, as for poker, it supplied plenty of material to write about, but at a high cost since he was terrible at it, though he liked to brag otherwise. His friend Dave Peltz remembered that when a straight fell into his hands, Nelson's eyes shone, quote, like bright lights. He couldn't hide it. One of the things about writing about Nelson is it's a great life of, it's light and dark, mm-hmm. like all great subjects, don't you think?
Yeah, well, he was, he was in many ways, he was a strange fellow. He had a hard time maintaining friendships. He would end friendships unexpectedly, and people would wonder what happened, why he suddenly turned on them. Yeah. And yet when he was, and they would also tell me that when he was your friend, he'd be a great friend. He would, you know, give you great gifts. He would promote other writers. One of the writers that he helped promote was Gwendolyn Brooks.
Yeah. He's a complicated, complicated guy. But I'm telling you, Mary Wisniewski in this biography, what I consider, there's no need for anybody to write another Nelson Algren biography, Nelson Algren on Life. It reads theatrically and cinematically. This would, if they could find somebody to play Nelson, be a great, great book. Time for a break, kids. See, I've got Jasmine Cooper here, who was weaned on the great Rick Pearson show, who taught her everything that a great producer needs to know. We're going to take a break, then we'll get some news, and Mary and I will carry on, and I will read you a letter that Mary uncovered here that is, I find, almost sad to the point of being almost tragic about Nelson and how he felt about himself and his life. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is me, Rick Kogan, doing his best to fill in for Bill and Wendy. And I've been talking with and will continue to talk with my colleague and friend, Mary Wisniewski, who has written a remarkable biography on any level, not just because it's about someone I knew. It is Algren of Life. It's about Nelson Algren, the most famous Chicago writer ever, even though he was born in Detroit. Mary, if you had to tell somebody, the people out there, to read, after they read Algren of Life, what would you tell them to read next? Meaning, what Algren book would you want people to read? I think they'll be drawn to a number of them from your book.
One of the fun things is that when people read this book, they write me and say, now I want to read Algren, which has been really, really satisfying. That's what I
wanted. Oh, no kidding.
But I would tell people to read his prose poem, Chicago City on the Make, which was originally intended for a travel magazine that was dedicated to Chicago, and he turned it into something quite different.
Quite different. Yeah, you interviewed me about it. Even I say that in the book, Chicago writer Rick Kogan, son of Algren's friends Herman and Mary Lou, speaking 60 years after the book's publication, said that Chicago City on the Make may be Algren's work that endures the longest. Quote, Nelson's use of language for me is much more apparent in City on the Make and in some of his short stories than it is in his novels. I think that's where his literary genius lies. Studs Circle called the book Algren's love-hate poem to his city, revealing Algren as both a clown and a prophet. As I mentioned before, there is a heart-wrenching part of a letter that he wrote to Amanda. This is it. This is a very self-confessional kind of thing that most people would not venture to say outside of a psychiatrist's couch. But here is Nelson Algren writing about his trouble dealing with people and lack of trust. Quote, probably short of a book, I could not explain my feeling for people. I'm so detached from them and so afraid of them that I desire to end the suspense. It isn't so simple that one might assume the fear is of merely facing anyone, talking to anyone. I can do that, even with aplomb, even with brilliance. But when the act is done, I've not got anything, only a sharpened sense of being away. When you first read that must have stunned you, yes?
Yeah, it reminded me, for one thing, how much this is a letter to both his first and second wife.
Yes.
This is a woman he married twice. And how much he loved her and how close a relationship they must have had for him to be able to write this kind of confessional letter to him. It also struck me how much he lost when they became alienated from each other after their second divorce, when they stopped talking to each other, because he lost that person that he could be completely honest with. And it also struck me that it explained to me why he could be so perverse in public, why he was such a clown and was always kind of putting his foot in his mouth and alienating people, because he just didn't know how to behave with people, and he knew it.
Yeah. What do you attribute that to? I, for one, can't quite figure it out. I can't pin it to, ooh, look at this in his childhood. He's a difficult psychological conundrum.
Well, he was a very, very exquisitely sensitive person who was growing up in a time when sensitivity was not valued in men and not valued in people in general. And I think he felt that conflict all the time between what I have to be a tough guy, and yet I want a woman to stay home and make my pot roast and wash my socks, and yet I want a woman who I can speak with as an equal. And I want to be able to be a great literary poet, but I also want to be respected as a tough guy, as someone who plays poker and knows how to box and all these things. And there were all these different conflicts in what he thought that a man should be.
Yeah.
And he was always looking for this model of what a man should be. Ernest Hemingway was a big hero of his. And I think that he looked to Ernest as someone he thought a man should be. And I think that, of course, Hemingway killed himself.
Yes.
He was also not able to resolve those
conflicts.
Well, and
of course, Hemingway played the role, I think, much more effectively and publicly than Nelson ever could have.
Well, he was able to pose in magazines with, brandy and
dead
cigars.
And dead animals.
And dead animals. And, yeah, he was able to market it better than Algren ever did.
Do you think he was really in love with Simone de Beauvoir, or do you think that was all also part of the Nelson act?
I think that, judging from how, other people describe their relationship, that yes, he was. Friends of Simone de Beauvoir describe him as being, meek with him and romantic and like a little boy, and calling her Simone when everyone else was calling her Castor, which was slang for beaver, which is what her friends called her. And that, they were with each other like sweethearts, like newlyweds. They would sit together holding hands. And I think that he saw in her someone that, for one thing, she was a rather beautiful woman.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that they connected with each other physically, but also they were able to help each other.
This is a very tough question to ask you, Mary Wisniewski, the author, my colleague, friend, and author of Algren, A Life. If somehow we could massage time and you could have met the 40-year-old Nelson Algren when you were a 35-year-old reporter, you must have. I mean, you spent so much time with him in this book and so much, good time to create this portrait of him. What do you think you would have thought?
He was a good-looking guy. And from what I heard from people who talked about him, he was very good with women. He would listen to them, and that's something that a woman always wants, to be listened to, and to be listened to in a close way that, you felt like he was hearing every word. And so I think that I could understand why women found him attractive.
Yeah.
Of course, knowing what I do from his life, I don't think I would have wanted to have dated him.
Yeah.
Also, wouldn't have wanted to be his mother.
That's a very, very interesting take. We're going to take a short commercial break, and when we come back, talk to Mary a little more, and we're going to play a very interesting video clip so you can hear Nelson Algren talk and get a sense of his humor, because he's being interviewed at a party in Chicago before he leaves Chicago by his great friend Studs Terkel, who is like giggling throughout the entire thing. Just a few more minutes for me, Rick Kogan, filling in for Bill and Wendy with Mary Wisniewski, who you can read in the Tribune. She's actually in about 10 minutes going downstairs to finish a story. Her beat is the transportation beat, which is complex and chaotic and everything else. It's a great beat, don't you think?
Oh, Mary? Yeah. No, it's so much fun because everyone cares.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to know.
Yeah, except, Ken Griffin and other rich people who don't ever take public transportation. Her book, which should be on every one of your Christmas gift book lists, is Algren, A Life, about the terribly complicated but astonishingly talented Nelson Algren, born in Detroit, but as identifiable with Chicago as any writer has ever been. He wound up leaving here, Mary. Why?
He left because he was working on a book about Hurricane Carter, the boxer who was unfairly accused of killing three people. And Nelson took up in the and Carter was out in that was out in Paterson, New Jersey. And Nelson always wanted to be in the place that he was writing about. He just couldn't. He didn't want to go to Paris and live with Simone because he couldn't stand not being in Chicago and writing about Chicago. And so I think that the main reason he went out is because he wanted to be in the place where the subject was. Though he made all sorts of excuses about, I can't stand Chicago anymore.
Yeah,
blah,
I'm
blah.
Not respected here, blah, blah, blah. It was a big deal when he left. He auctioned off much of his stuff. And here is a clip, a rare YouTube clip, really actually from MediaBurn.org, if you want to see some great old clips. Here is... at a party in Chicago, Studs Terkel, Nelson's very good friend, interviewing Nelson Algren about why he's leaving. You'll not only hear Nelson's voice, but you get a sense of his sort of odd sense of humor. Thanks, Jasmine.
The question comes up about Nelson moving, leaving Chicago, and he's moved to Paterson. The question is your reaction. You described Paterson as a boom town.
Yeah, well, it is. It is. It's booming in welfare. No, downtown Paterson is really something you shouldn't see after midnight. No, it's a lovely little city, and... I mean, it's just my kind of town, that's all. I just like it. I like it.
It's your kind of town.
Yeah, I like it. I like Paterson. Well, Jersey City, you see, I mean, the reason I call Paterson a boomtown is Jersey City has always been a welfare city. But Paterson is coming from behind because it used to be affluent. No, it was a very affluent textile city. And now all the silk factories and the silk machinery is gone. And they're wholly dependent on welfare. So they're in close competition now. And they're really catching up with Jersey City. You can't walk across the city anymore. No, you can't. No, the cab drivers told me that. I said, I lived here all my life. I love the city, but I can't walk across it anymore. No, it's very sad.
Why go there?
Well, I didn't really go there. I just stopped off, and it was Paterson. You know, that's as far as I could go. The train didn't go any further. No, the train went to Newark, actually. And in Newark, I couldn't get a room, so I took a bus to Paterson. Then I was sorry I didn't stay in Newark when I saw the rooms in Paterson. It's a town that makes Gary, Indiana look extremely affluent. Yeah.
People will ask you, what do you plan to do? Nelson Org, what do you plan to do in Paterson?
Well, I plan to belong to the community, to work with the Boy Scouts and the Junior Chamber of Commerce, and to, you know, help put it back on its feet. I mean, that's my... I mean, it needed me. I could see Paterson needed me, so I stayed on.
Do you think you might conceive where you run for office and take part in public life?
Oh, I'm sure they'll ask me to run. I mean, they like me. They like me in Paterson.
You know, Chicago will miss you. The question is, will you miss Chicago?
No, I've never missed Chicago. No, I mean, I don't. Chicago, and I don't think Chicago's going to miss me. No, Chicago won't miss me. I mean, I went up to the public library the other day. I've written 10, 11 books, and there isn't one there. They are in Tokyo. They're in the public library in Tokyo and in Paris and in about 10, 11 cities, and not in Chicago.
Won't Studs miss you?
No, Studs can get by. I mean, of course he'll miss me, but after all, Studs survived the Chicago fire. Why, you know, he can survive this too. He survived the loss of the 1959 pennant to Brooklyn. You know, he still lived on. So.
L.A.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, are you going to miss him?
Oh, I'll miss him. Yeah, I don't want Nelson to miss the city. I don't know, but certainly there are a number of people, quite a few people in Chicago, will miss Nelson, quite obviously. And I ask you why.
Well, I love New Jersey. And I love San Francisco, and New Jersey is on the way.
Well, how will you get from New Jersey to San Francisco?
Well, it's very close. I'm near the port of New York now. Yeah. And so I can get a ship out to any of the North African ports, or Barcelona, Marseille. I go down the Mediterranean. And I stop in one of the Greek ports, and you go down. Then you go down down the Persian Gulf and around. I know I've been to India, so I won't stop there. But you go around India, and you go right to the port of Yokohama. I won't go to Korea because, well, that's out of the way. I don't want to go out of the way. And then then you go down to the Philippines, and from Manila or Luzon, you can get a ship in 2 weeks. You can get to San Diego from the Philippines. But if you don't stop in Hawaii, I don't want to waste any time in Hawaii. It takes only 2 weeks on a freight ship, and then from San Diego, you're only 45 minutes from San Francisco.
So you move to Patterson.
It's a direct move.
Then get close to San Francisco.
Yeah. No, I love San Francisco. My father was born there. I always wanted to get back. And so this is, they expect me there.
I think they got it. I've already got the reason moving to San Francisco to get to San Francisco. And then they'd like some.
Well, I don't see why people think it's out of the way. Unless you think the world is square or something. I mean, you don't have to. In other words, if I went there directly, I'd have to go through Denver. And anyway, you know. I mean, well, no. I mean, it's much better the other way, you know.
Sud Circle and Nelson Algren, a laughing woman in the background. Mayor Wisniewski, it's not my place to be proud of you, but this is a tough, Nelson Algren is a tough subject to tackle, because I knew him, my parents knew him well. You have made him flesh and blood, which is really an accomplishment, and you have made his life story as compelling as any of his novels or short stories or City on the Make. It's a brilliant, brilliant job of writing. This book should be on your Christmas. Please, people, I hope you still give books at Christmas. I think there is nothing quite like a book at Christmas time. Merry, happy Thanksgiving to you and your family. And, well, I'll see you in the office.
Ooh, happy Thanksgiving to you, and thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's about time. We're trying to get her on, you know, that Sunday night show I have, and this is all of you driving in cars and or stuck in traffic. Nothing better to listen to. Coming up after the news, Bob Mamet, the jazz musician, younger brother of a certain playwright named David Mamet, who's also a pretty good Chicago writer. If David had stayed here, I think David might be more famous than Nelson, but David's pretty famous as it is.
He's doing all right.
Yeah, he's doing just fine. Mary, thanks a million. Honey.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you. We get a commercial. I'll read you a commercial. Then we'll get another commercial. Then we'll get some news. And then Bob Mamet will be in here and you'll hear some music. That really is good, Bob Mamet. That really is good. Bob Mamet, my great friend and a longtime friend, his whole family is a longtime friends of mine, is in here. That is you playing the piano, isn't it, Bob?
Yes. Thanks, Rick.
What CD is this?
This is London House Blues.
Well, you'll be hearing much more of Bob during this hour, talking also about his career. He has a friend of his who is an eminent jazz critic who I will put on after 11:30 to give her take on Bob. The music Bob plays is incredibly, I think, accessible is the word. And I know a lot of people think, oh, man, I don't like jazz because all they know is Miles Davis or something not as accessible. When did you come to music, Bob Mamet? You're a local kid.
Yeah.
When did you first come to music?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, there was always music playing in the house. My dad played, my brother played. And so it was just something kind of I was born into. It kind of came naturally, you know.
Did you at high school, Francis Parker, actively play?
Yeah, we did. We had a little group, a little combo, you know, when I was...
A jazz combo?
Yeah, yeah.
In high school?
Yeah, I did, yeah. And we would play for it was kind of a captive audience because we would have these assemblies and everyone in the school would have to come. So they had no choice but to listen.
jazz, though, for a high school kid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm thinking that, you know, most high school kids that I knew, and I'm older than you are, it was like, oh, we're going to have a rock band. We're going to do a rock band. What was it about jazz that drew you? I mean, I know you are a fan of all genres of music. There's no question about that.
Right.
What drew you specifically and so hard to jazz?
Well, you know, I think, you know, my father was a big jazz fan. He was a fan of all the great jazz pianists, like Oscar Peterson and Bill Evans and players like that, Earl Father Hines, you know, the greats of jazz piano. So I would just by osmosis, I think I you know, took it up.
You
know?
And you found, were you playing a trio when you were in high school?
Well, I was doing, different bands and different combos. And I would, I mean, ever, you know, that's kind of how I began. I would mix the jazz, you know, that I would learn with the, like you say, the rock and the contemporary music of the day, you know, that just as that you grow up with in the 70s, basically.
And when do you decide? It always fascinates me. It's sort of fascinating. I can't even remember when I decided, well, what I want to do is write for a living.
Yes.
Without really understanding that it's difficult to make a living in any art form.
Yes.
When did you decide to give that a shot, and why?
Well, you know, I moved to L.A. I moved to Southern California when I was still, you know, in my early 20s, and I lived there actually about 30 years, it was just something that I was drawn into to music and to be in that profession. I did a lot of different things.
What did you do in college, though? Where'd you go to college and what did you study?
Yes.
He laughs.
Well, I went, yes, I actually.
You still have a guy. I didn't go, so I should be the one laughing.
Well, I went to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. And while I was there, I also had the opportunity. I was lucky. I had the opportunity while I was at Johns Hopkins to study extensively at the Peabody Conservatory, which is like one of our premier conservatories in the country. And so that even, you know, that drew me even more so into music. And then I went to the West Coast and the studying I did there was more of the professional nature with
Were you good when you were at Peabody? Were you good? And did you think at the time I might be good enough to make this my career? Because there's got to be a moment, a revelatory moment. Isn't there, Bob, where you think,
yes,
I actually could do this?
Yes, I thought I was pretty good. And then I went to the conservatory, and one of my instructors, Jose Esteban, he was an Oscar-winning composer, and he was very, you know, he had a good sense of humor, you know, and he said, what kind of, he asked me, I said, I'm a composer, you know, and I was all of 18, 19 years old, and he said, oh, really, what do you compose?
Oh, really? Yeah. How many times has he heard that from an 18-year-old? Yes, I'm a composer.
And basically he said, you know, you have a lot to learn, my friend.
Oh, funny.
It humbled me. And when you're that age, you have, you know, you're brash maybe.
Sure.
But then under the right tutelage, I think, then you just kind of shut up a little and listen. You know, let others do the talking.
When did you, Bob Mamet, start composing?
I was, you know,
at Parker as a mid-teen.
Yeah, I was. Yes, I was composing all just, you know, when I was young, I started composing just little ditties, I guess call them, and then more serious composing, you know, that actually turned into actual tunes that anyone would want to listen to a little later in my 20s, early 30s.
So you graduated Johns Hopkins with a degree in...
No,
I
left Johns Hopkins and went to the West Coast and studied there. Yeah.
I
made a clean break and I said, I'm just going.
Amazing dad, Bernie, and your lovely mom, Judy, think of you when you said, hey, mom and dad, I'm going to go out to California. I'm through with college, and I want to be a musician. What was the reaction? I'll tell you something. That is a crucial element to anybody's career, to have parents who will at least indulge you, if not support you.
Right. I think their first reaction was like, California. There's a bunch of crazy people out there.
Right.
That was their first reaction. But then they warmed up. It took him a while, but they warmed up to the idea.
What'd you do in California? You studied where?
Yes. Well, I studied at several places, Pepperdine University, and then I studied at the Dick Grove School of Music, which was a finishing school for studio musicians. Yeah.
And is that what were your career thoughts at the time?
Well,
there's no denying your passion. I mean, no denying your passion.
Right.
But you got to make a living.
It was a little different. It was a little different back then because things have changed a little since then. I almost want to call it a studio system in music, you know, where there was like a hierarchy. You would go, you would play in the studios, kind of work your way up, and then compose for different jingles and things like that, which I did. And I did a lot of composing for international, overseas action films and horror films, which
wow.
was all, you know, real popular. They loved anything American culture, American movies, American music back then, and there was a big market for it
yeah.
over there. So it was like kind of almost there was a method to it. Nowadays, I'm not sure that's exactly, you know, how it works because, you know, things have changed a lot in the music industry.
Well, we've gotten Bob Mamet from Chicago to the East Coast. Now he's on the West Coast, and we'll continue on, and you will hear a great deal of his music. He is performing Tuesday. Now, you don't perform enough, Bob. I'll tell you that right now. He's performing Tuesday night at the Jazz Showcase. Two shows?
Yes, 8 and 10.
8 and 10. It is with his trio, and all original stuff?
It's about half originals. And then some jazz standards, and we're going to throw in a few of my versions of holiday tunes, a couple of them.
Oh, nice. We'll take a break, during which I will tell you this. Holidays and the new year bring cherished moments and smiles we capture forever. This year, we are proud to celebrate our 10th year milestone of the famous WGN Chicago personalized calendars, a favorite gift among our listeners. This year's calendars are completely redesigned with a fresh new look and feel by our friends at 2Ks. And with all new stunning photography of our beautiful city, you can personalize any name you want with authentic realism. Imagine your recipient's name in prominent landmarks creatively illustrated for every month. Available now at WGNradio.com. Give these calendars to coworkers, family, and friends. It's a practical and useful gift used every day of the year. Something your gift recipient will always remember you by. Go to WGNradio.com and scroll down to the featured section to order yours today. 2018 Epic Calendars for an epic year, we hope. I'm talking for this entire hour to Bob Mamet. Incredibly, if you just heard, you know, dropped out of this school and went to California and music for strange foreign films, you would not come close to appreciating the depth of his talent, especially on his latest CD is London House Blues, a remarkable gathering of original tunes. He will be at Jazz Showcase for two shows this coming Tuesday at 8 and 10. So you're out in L.A.
Yes.
You're making your way.
Yeah.
When do you start making a living doing what you love?
Well, I was in my 20s. You know, it was, you know, I wouldn't particularly call it glamorous. You know, I was doing studio work, playing as a session musician and doing composing for whatever jingles and, international movies, whatever, you know, kind of came my way.
Sure.
And then at some point, I don't know, I put a demo tape together on cassette. And, took it around to the record labels, and I was signed to Atlantic Records.
When there were record labels, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There used to be actual record labels, and then I was signed to Atlantic Records.
How did you celebrate? It's a huge, huge step, Bob, and as talented as you may have thought you were, that sort of gives credibility to whatever you were thinking. How did you celebrate?
Well, it's funny because you think, I mean, I was probably at that point, I was maybe in my late 20s, and now I think of that as quite young, but at the time, you know, when you've been toiling in the music industry for, you know, about a decade,
sure,
it seems like an eternity. It seems like it's taken you so long to finally, you know, get to where you think maybe you want to go. Yeah.
You had a one of the nice things out there, even though your mom, Judy, the lovely Judy, and your dad, the great Bernie Mamet, were here. You had a nice foundation out there. Your brother Tony was out there for much of the time you were in L.A. Your older half-brother David Mamet, the famous playwright, movie maker, now upcoming novelist, was out there. You would see them all the time. I mean, that I think is a crucially important element for someone who is trying to break into any kind of business, to have a familial foundation.
That is important. And, you know, L.A. is so spread out. There's really no, there's no city like Chicago.
Right,
there's a city. L.A., it's just, a bunch of spread out suburbs. So you could go months without seeing your best friends there. So you have to, make like a plan to actually see family and friends there. And it is important to have that foundation.
One of the things, I think it's great that you moved back to Chicago after the news. We'll talk about that. But let's let people listen to an entire song. We got a few, like 4 minutes now before we have to break for news. The great Ben Cortez's engineering. What would you like to hear? What do you think this vast audience sitting in their cars on expressways trying to get to grandmother's house would like to hear?
From the impromptu album, Cats on the Roof, number 2.
How about Cats on the Roof, number 2, Ben? This is from Bob Mamet. This is Rick Cogan filling in for Bill and Wendy. I'm going to be on the WGNRadio.com thing from noon to 1, also talking about and listening to Bonnie Kolak and also talking about Theater on the Lake. I have some more time, though, with Bob Mamet. You can learn more about Bob at BobMamet.com. You can also learn from me that he will be at the Jazz Showcase Tuesday night for two shows at 8 and 10. A lot of tunes from his great London House Blues CD, maybe a little sample of his upcoming CD, maybe a couple of Christmas things we were talking about on Sunday, my regular show After Hours on Sunday night. Joe Siegel, the genius behind Jazz Showcase, is going to be there. You could not admire Joe more, could you?
Oh, no, he's a great. Joe Siegel is one of the great impresarios of Chicago jazz. And his, I mean, he's created arguably like a world-class, internationally known, world-class jazz club here in Chicago. And one of the best, you know, people come from all over the world to play here and actually to come here jazz. You know, they. I last time I was playing there, a whole tour group from Holland came in. And, you know, I mean, it was just a lot of different, you know,
audience. What did you do at Lincoln Center with him?
Oh, yeah. Well, what happened was, you know, Joe was honored. He got the highest honor or one of the highest honors you could get from the National Endowment of the Arts. And at Lincoln Center, they had a ceremony for him. And I contributed. I was one of the composers who contributed to the presentation that they play before the ceremony. So I was honored to do that because, I mean, Joe's are just, a giant in the world of jazz
well,
and presenting
this,
jazz.
Look at it this way, Bob, and you know it, even though you spent a great deal of time in California before coming back here a few years ago. Imagine Chicago all these decades without Jazz Showcase.
Yeah, right.
It's a wasteland then.
Right, because, see, I think Chicago rivals just about any city in the world in terms of jazz. It really does. Of course, you have New York and you have Paris, two other good jazz cities, too. But I mean, I think Chicago's right up there with any and also the appreciation. I think, you know, audiences have a really real appreciation of jazz here, which is great.
Well, speaking of that, you brought in a friend, but also one of the eminent jazz critics in town. Might you introduce her to the audience?
This is my friend, Jen Helley. Yes.
And you are not just you have a regular job, but you're also a jazz critic of sorts. And, you know, we're all critics, though, John. We are all critics. Yeah. And one of the things that distinguishes Bob Mamet's music, as my great pal Kathy Murray will tell you, is that Bob is accessible and his music is the sort that will get under your skin. Do you agree?
Absolutely, Rick. And I think you stole that word from me, I like to think.
I did.
I've known Bob for almost 40 years, and I credit him for developing my jazz taste or, you know, developing my appreciation for jazz. I think jazz is a very, if you're not a musician, I think it's a difficult genre to really appreciate, at least it was for me. And I've been watching and listening, you know, to Bob play the piano and perform.
Since high school?
Since I was 15 years old.
Now, did you get hooked at 15?
I got hooked on watching Bob. I've developed a taste for listening to jazz overall over the last 38 years. And you use the word accessible. And part of what Bob does that really helps people appreciate it is as he performs, he'll throughout his show, you know, explain history, describe what's important about the songs and how he developed what he composed and why it's important, because there are such amazing stories behind, you know, the jazz composers. He talked about Jazz Showcase. He's mentioned, you know, Oscar Peterson. I mean, these are things I knew nothing about. It really helps me appreciate what he's doing and why I'm sitting there, because I was one of those kids who, you know, throughout grade school and high school, I'd fall asleep to AM radio. And if the song didn't have lyrics, it wasn't.
Yeah, right. I think that is one of the huge problems with. And a lot of people will get, and you can get in on this too, Bob, that a lot of people will get turned off by jazz because they just didn't listen to the right. You know, jazz is everything from, you know, Sun Ra to Ella Fitzgerald. And
yes.
that's a big space here.
Right. It's true. There's a big umbrella, you know, under the umbrella of jazz. And some of it is, you know, it's a matter of taste, I would say. Yeah.
Now, you will be at this Jazz Showcase first show, or are you staying for both?
Well,
you one of those hard
partying. I don't really want to disclose my age, but let's just say where I'm in my latter half century. So I will be at the first show at 8, and I will be there in force with many people who I've brought along to a lot of Bob's, you know, shows. And
well, one of the other things that, and thank you for coming on to talk about this, is you can get, and one of the other things that I think sells Bob as a performer, there is a palpable joy to watching him play. This is a person who is, who is immersed in and tremendously enjoying what they are doing on stage. Do you agree with that?
It's funny you mention that. We have a good mutual friend, Mike, who came in from a far western suburb to one of the last jazz showcase shows he did. Came for the 8 o'clock show, early morning job. I left at about 10:30. He was going nowhere. He stayed. It was one of the first times he saw Bob perform. And it's difficult to drag people out of there. He'd never seen Bob perform. And that palpable joy you describe was exactly. And he since then has bought every album. He travels a lot in his car. He's constantly texting. I'm listening to Bob now. So that was all Bob.
Wow.
I didn't have to convince him. He came, saw one show, and that was it for him.
That is fantastic. Thank you for offering your passionate
Thanks, Jen.
Jazz review, Jen. We got to take a break. Then we'll talk a little more about the show this Tuesday, the two shows, 8 and 10 at Jazz Showcase. And I will ask Bob to pick another song for you stuck in your car somewhere to hear. You want to say something? Wait, go ahead.
No, why don't we play?
We'll do it after the commercial.
Oh, okay. All
okay.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We have to wait after the commercial. Bob will do what he's just was about to do. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
Welcome back. It's Rick Kogan filling in for Bill and Wendy, wishing you all a happy Thanksgiving and wishing you are able to get to wherever you're going and aren't trapped in a car. But nothing wrong with being trapped in a car if you're listening to Bob Mamet. Bob Mamet will be performing Tuesday at 8 and 10 at the Jazz Showcase. You can find out all about Bob at his website, BobMamet.com. You love playing Showcase.
Oh, yeah. It's one of my favorite venues in the country.
Yeah. What do you want people to hear? I want people to hear you again, because Bob's intensely... Uh-huh. Our guest here, Jen, fell in love with his music when she was 15, and she is still in love with his music. It's the most durable relationship a person could have. What do you want to hear?
Well, you know, I think, you know, with the, I have a tune called Solstice that I kind of trot out around this time of year. This is kind of, I think, maybe appropriate for this time of year.
Mr. Cortez, if you would. Okay, hearing it is one thing, and it sounds beautiful and great, but seeing it adds a new dimension, because Bob's the eminent jazz critic. Jen and I have told you that seeing Bob perform is to see and experience his passion beyond the sort of icy CD. Bob will be doing that Tuesday at shows 8 and 10 at the Jazz Showcase. You are working on, in the 3 minutes we have left, you got a new CD that's going to be out in the spring, don't you?
That's right, yeah. It's actually a live CD that I recorded in Paris. And
lucky you.
we'll be releasing that one in the spring. And actually, a lot of the tunes that are on that one, I'll be playing on Tuesday at the Jazz Showcase as well.
Really? So, yeah. What's the difference between that and London House Blues? I thought was your latest. It was inspired.
Yes.
Inspired selection. What's
right? Well, that's the London House Blues. That was an album of a lot of, like, I would say classic standards on that album, and. Most of my albums feature more of my originals. So this live one, the Live from Paris album, is going to be a mixture. It's going to be a mixture of my originals and also some standards.
Well, guess who will be buying many copies of that? You have a big plan for Thanksgiving or no?
Nothing astronomical, but I. How about you, Rick? I was saying, one of these times I'm going to come
when
in.
When is Thanksgiving tomorrow?
yes.
Okay, well, I'll figure it out. I've got a whole day.
there
day.
You go.
I have to do is after this, Jasmine Cooper, the world's greatest. Lise Graham is a great producer. Jasmine Cooper's the greatest producer I've ever had in the daylight hours. The greatest producer in the daylight. And Ben Cortez and I will move to another studio where we will be on WGNRadio.com, I think. And what you'll be hearing then is I interviewed some time ago the people who run Theater on the Lake, which is at the foot of Fullerton on the lakefront. And it just opened. And it's one of the most spectacular places I have ever seen in this town. It'll be booked for weddings for the next 50 years. You'll hear from those people. You'll also hear from Bonnie Kolak, who's not a small talent, who I interviewed a few weeks ago on my nightly show. So you two have fun. I will see you both Tuesday. Don't get up and start screaming like, I think Bob is so accessible. Just, have fun, have a drink. We'll take a little commercial break, then we'll get some news, and then you'll get Steve Bertrand and the Wintrust Business Report, and you'll get me online somewhere. We'll be right back. Well, I'm done with what passes for live interviews covering for Bill and Wendy. I hope they are having a nice pre-Thanksgiving day somewhere. I hope you are not too angst-filled. These holidays, there's a reason that the Thanksgiving holiday is the biggest drinking days of the year, because people, a lot of pressure, a lot of familial pressure and, guilt and all sorts of things. So I hope you have a nice, restful, enjoyable holiday. I am going to be online talking about replaying an old Theater on the Lake interview I did some time ago before they opened. They are now open now. And then talking to the one and only Bonnie Kolak.